This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. I am here every week at this time. Welcome. Here's where we talk about what's going on in the economy and what it might mean for your money. On today's program, I have a couple of really great interviews for you. I'm going to catch up with Mr. Carl Denninger. I'm going to talk to Carl today about monetary policy and an angle that a lot of people don't think too much about. What has today's artificially low interest rate environment done to pension plans? And is there more trouble brewing? And what might it mean for you and your money? And if you're expecting a pension, it's something you'll certainly want to pay attention to. I'll be getting to my conversation with Carl momentarily. Also, I caught up this past week with Mr. Neil Howe. Neil is the best-selling author of The Fourth Turning. He also wrote a book titled Generations back in the 90s, which is a very relevant, very good read yet today. Neil is a very prolific author. He is the president and founder of Saculum Research, and I know you're going to like the conversation that I had with Neil as well. We have an additional free resource for you that I'd like to remind you of if you're not yet a subscriber to our weekly Portfolio Watch newsletter. You can get a free subscription by visiting the website, yourretirementoutlook.com. That's Y-O-U-R, yourretirementoutlook.com. Just let us know your name and email address, and we'll be glad to get you a free subscription to our newsletter that's delivered every week. So again, the website, yourretirementoutlook.com. If you'd like to go back and listen to any of the guest expert interviews that I do each week, you can do so by visiting the website, everythingfinancialradio.com. Or you can go to the iTunes store and search under Everything Financial Radio. All the podcasts there are free, and you can listen to any of our past interviews with guest experts whenever you would like. So again, everythingfinancialradio.com, or if you'd prefer, go to the iTunes store and search under Everything Financial Radio. I am pleased to have as a returning guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Carl Denninger. Carl is the prolific blogger, and you'll find his work at market-ticker.org. And Carl, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
Carl, let's talk a bit about what's going on in Japan. It was reported this past week. Japan is now officially back in recession. Is that a surprise to you?
Not even slightly. The Japanese monetary authorities, just like our monetary authorities, seem to think that you can cure what ails the economy by destroying people's purchasing power. And that's what quantitative easing and money printing, and no matter what form you try to put it in, that's what that is. The problem with doing it is that you're just increasing the denominator. And so the cost of something goes up, but the amount of money you make does not. So therefore, you must be able to buy less by definition. And there are certain people that get a benefit from this, specifically the banks and the people who get their hands on this new liquidity first. But the common person does not get a benefit. They get the cost. And so it's kind of like doing drugs. You start out, you get nice and high, and everything feels great. And then after you get good and addicted, you need the drug in order to not feel like, you know, like crap and go through withdrawals, but you don't get a buzz off of it anymore. And then essentially that's what's happened in Japan, is that they're now addicted to this path that Abenomics is on, but they're not getting any of the benefits. They're just getting the costs.
So, Carl, when you look at this and you see that Japan has been really on a money printing binge for longer than the United States, why is it that, since money printing doesn't work, that seems to be the only policy central banks are now pursuing around the world?
Well, what other policies do they have available to them? I mean, that's this is what you kind of have to think about, is that if you're going to go chase some other form of policy, what would it be? And see, that's always the challenge that you have for monetary authorities, is that all they have is a hammer. And so whenever something pops up, they look at it and say, oh, that's a nail. Why? I mean, it's the age-old problem. If all I've got is a screwdriver, I'm going to try to find a way to use it.
So Carl, what's the end game here? How does this all end? It appears that Japan's obviously in recession. It's my view the United States is probably, in spite of the rosy economic news we hear from a lot of the talking heads on television, it seems that the U.S. is headed back that way as well. Are we headed for a worldwide period of deflation, or can central banks avoid that outcome?
I don't understand why a central bank would want to avoid deflation. Deflation is good for the common person because your wages stay relatively constant, just like they have during this attempted reflation. But the cost of living goes down, so your purchasing power goes up. That's good for everybody except for the people that want to get their hands on the money supply first and try to multiply it through leverage. But in terms of whether or not the central banks of the world can avoid this outcome, the answer is no, because when you do this, when you undertake these programs, all you're doing is increasing the denominator. And so ultimately what ends up happening is that the common person who has to drive the economy, because let's face it, the consumption is ultimately what drives all economies, runs out of purchasing power, and they get squeezed at a higher and higher level. And so you start with the people that are the poorest, and it works its way up. But when it gets into the middle class, it starts damaging their lifestyles. Then it becomes serious, because those people make up the bulk of the purchasing within the non-discretionary area. So when you start squeezing their discretionary spending, you're basically putting the brakes on what drives economic progress.
So, Carl, moving ahead, do you see that the Fed will try to engage in another QE program to combat what maybe what I perceive to be another real estate bubble and a stock market bubble? And let me know whether or not you agree with that assessment.
Well, I think we have a huge bubble in the stock market right now, because the valuations that the shares are selling at in general, it bears absolutely no relationship to reality. It's being fueled by buybacks and crazy M&A valuations and things like this. But and housing is also starting to get very bubbly again. The problem that the Fed has with QE, or for that matter staying at zero interest rates, is that they have built in tremendous damage into the pension funds throughout the United States. And that damage is reaching a critical level. That's the reason that I said a year and a half ago they were going to stop QE. They didn't have a choice. I don't think they can do another round of QE. If they were to engage in another round of that, they would probably set up the mass failure of pension funds and ultimately Medicare and Social Security some 5 to 10 years down the road, which ends up with a failed state in the U.S. So I don't see that happening. I think they're trying to find any excuse to get off of that dime, because those people need to have that damage stopped. There is no other way to have these programs even pay out a small fraction of what they've committed to spend. The money's just not there.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for this segment. However, in the last segment of today's program, we'll continue our conversation with Mr. Carl Denninger, and we'll get his take and more of an explanation as to why QE, in his view, can't continue, and how that may adversely affect pension funds should it continue. Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I will be continuing my conversation with Carl Denninger in the last segment of today's program. Before I get to my conversation with Mr. Neil Howe, let me remind you that we do have an additional resource for you. It's our Portfolio Watch newsletter, which is free, distributed by email each week. If you'd like to get a complimentary subscription, just visit yourretirementoutlook.com, yourretirementoutlook.com. I'm pleased to have as a guest on today's Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Neil Howe. Neil is the president of Saculum Research. He is a prolific author. I have read his book, Generations and the Fourth Turning. Both, in my opinion, are must-reads. And Neil, I am very much pleased to have you back on the program. Welcome.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Neil, you recently had a piece published in Forbes talking about the parallels between the current decade and the 1930s, and that's a topic that we have explored with guests here on the program. Talk, if you would, just initially speaking, about some of the just the big picture economic similarities between the current decade and the 30s, if you would.
Well, I think when we're talking about decade parallels, I guess the economics ones are most easily recognizable. The 30s was a decade of underemployment of both labor and capital. You know, we had high rates of unemployment and factories and warehouses and so on that were unused. It's also a decade in which people worried about deflation quite a bit. And it was also, in terms of foreign trade, it was a decade of dramatically declining global trade, along with trade wars and the tendency of major players to undercut each other in exchange rates. I mean, there were you know, aggressive use of exchange rate devaluation, and all of those obviously we've seen in this decade, right? High unemployment rates, whether or not they're officially measured or not, I would say that today, because of the disengagement from the labor force, we're really not measuring unemployment correctly. We obviously have not full use of capital, which explains why investment rates are so low, despite the fact that interest rates are practically through the floor. And fears of deflation, doesn't that ring a bell? Back in 1937, Alvin Hansen, who was a popularizer of Keynes in the United States, coined the term secular stagnation. And it's obvious, to me at least, it's no coincidence that Larry Summers repopularized that term about 3 years ago to describe our current situation. So, you know, there's kind of where we are. And it's not just, the parallels aren't just economic, but I think extend into demography and geopolitics and even in the culture.
Let me focus on and maybe drill down a bit on something you mentioned, Neil. You had mentioned deflation worries, and obviously when you think back to the 1930s, we saw significant declines in consumer prices across the board. I mean, the stock market crashed, the commodity markets crashed. Arguably, we're seeing commodity prices decline significantly. Do you see the end game today, this decade, the same as it was in the 30s, which is obviously very devastating for most American citizens?
Well, I think the end game is, you know, part of the morphology of what we call a fourth turning in history, and that is when your institutions reach a crisis point and nothing works, something truly urgent has to come along to kickstart things back in motion again. And it doesn't, in my opinion, have to be a war. We warn people, and you know this, you've read the book, that it's no coincidence that every fourth turning in American history has coincided with a total war, right? And so I think we should be aware of that. But I don't think it requires a war. What it does require, though, is suddenly something that causes people to recognize that the very integrity, politically, socially, institutionally, of our country is at stake, and that people start rewriting the rules of the game in terms of leadership and politics. And so fourth turnings are not just things that happen to us. They are things that we respond to, and through collective responses, rebuild the system, rebuild the institutions. I mean, that's what we did, obviously, in the Great Depression or World War II, and in the Civil War and the American Revolution. And, you know, you go on the various fourth turnings through back through history, and that I think is what we're facing. I don't make bets particularly on to what extent it will require war. I think that that wars typically, in some form or another, since they're kind of always around us and they're always kind of raging at some level, will be part of that process when you consider a fourth turning as an entire, you know, 20-year era in history. But again, I'm not focusing here on total war as the solution. As to some extent, it really was the catharsis coming out of that period in the 30s, and at the end of that period, the United States emerging as the dominant global hegemon and developing all of these global, completely new global institutions to secure an order, an ordered world for the next several decades. And I'm thinking of everything from the United Nations to Bretton Woods to the World Bank to the IMF and, you know, all of the stuff that we created along with various, you know, and the NATO alliance on the West and sort of locked in a stationary situation with the Warsaw Pact and the Second World in Eurasia. And, you know, that's kind of and that created an ordered world, which then sustained itself for the next several decades, or as we would say, for the next three turnings, right?
Neil, and if you're just joining us, we're chatting today with Mr. Neil Howe. And Neil, for our listeners that maybe aren't familiar with the terminology, the fourth turning, and you used that several times in our last dialogue, our last communication, can you explain exactly what that means?
Well, it's very simply, a turning is an era of history that's roughly the length of a generation. So if you think of generations as roughly 20-year units, basically the length of time between being born and fully coming of age as an adult, which is how social generations are often defined, a turning then becomes a period in which any given set of generations are each moving into a new phase of life. So, for example, you know, during the last fourth turning, this crisis turning, the famous the GI generation, what Tom Brokaw calls the greatest generation born in the first quarter of the 20th century, you know, the peers of John Kennedy and Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr. And all those guys were coming of age into adulthood, right? That was their generation, and that was the generation that that sort of dominated midlife and leadership when most boomers were young and growing up. And similarly, in the American high in the late 40s, 50s, early 60s, a new generation was coming of age, what we today call the silent generation. They're today people in their 70s and 80s, they were coming of age, and new generation of children are being born, namely boomers. And so you can see how that works. Every turning is a new alignment of generations, and it gives rise to a very different mood in that era. The subsequent era after the American High, of course, was the period of the cultural awakening, the consciousness revolution. This is when boomers were coming of age, and a new generation of today we call Generation X, born in the 60s and 70s, were being born, and so on. And we describe in the fourth turning, as you know, how each generation belongs to a certain type, a certain archetype, and the alignment of these generations by phases of life gives rise to a very distinctive mood, which we liken to seasons of the year, you know, spring, summer, fall, and winter. And the winter turning is the fourth turning, and that's these times of institutional crisis. We also have time. These are periods when we rebuild the outer world of politics, the economy, empire, and so forth. We also have what in periods we call second turnings, the great awakenings of American history, and these are periods when we rebuild the inner world of culture and religion and values and morals. And these are the turning points of American history, if you will, and it's broadly recognizable when you look at our history and the history of many other modern societies around the world. We think kind of beat to a roughly similar rhythm.
I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the distinct pleasure of chatting today with Mr. Neil Howe. Neil is the president of Saeculum Research, the author of a couple of must-read books, in my opinion, Generations, which was written a long time ago, but very applicable, and The Fourth Turning. And Neil, we chatted in the last segment about some of the economic similarities between this decade and the 1930s. Let's expand on that and talk about some of the cultural similarities.
Well, we see a number of other similarities as well, and when you're talking about a social mood, it really expresses itself in the economy, but expresses itself in other places as well. Obviously, demographics is associated with the economy. The 1930s was a period of great fear of fertility decline and falling birth rates, clearly connected to the economy. People, times were very difficult. The Great Depression was actually much deeper in the 30s than it has been, you know, in the 2010 decade. It was much deeper, but it actually didn't last as long. Our current period, particularly in Europe, is actually becoming to be a significantly longer depression than the Great Depression. But in any case, the sudden declining expectations of future income has a huge impact on demography. And I think just as the 1930s was filled with a great fear among many of the high-income countries of falling fertility rates and what that would mean and actually giving rise to some of the war fears in Europe, the same is true here. We have a declining fertility rate in the United States over the last few years after rising briskly and being a little bit higher than it was in the 70s when millennials were being born in the 80s and 90s. We now see this downtrend. We see it also in Europe as well. Geopolitics, I think, is an area where we see clear parallels to the 30s. In the 1930s, the lessons of World War I were abandoned. The League of Nations was pretty much repudiated and left toothless, and authoritarian regimes were free to do whatever they wanted in local areas and regions around the world, and gave rise to a great deal of worry about anarchy let loose in the world of power vacuums and even failed states. Exactly what we see today, where we see increasingly no one in charge, as it was during the earlier era when basically the United States, to the greatest extent, certainly the sea lanes and the global certainly supervised global trade, but also the Soviet Union sort of created this great world order. Well, we no longer see that today, and we see large areas of the world where either there is seemingly no power, no order being created by a power that's acting in the region. I'd say the Mideast is a good example of that. Or we see new powers that are basically exercising new authority in defiance of the old global hegemon. And that would be the primary examples there, I think, would be Russia, China, and perhaps to some extent Iran and others, and other smaller states in certain regions. The sense of global lawlessness and a rising worry about where that might lead, I think, is also very similar to what we saw in the 30s. Cultural parallels, I think, are also interesting. In the 1930s, we had in the United States the coming of age of the GI generation, which is a highly protected generation. The progressive movement, which was very strong in the 1900s and the 1910s, protected these kids. I mean, they dressed them as Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and Campfire Girls and 4-H clubs. For the first time, we dressed kids in uniform. We'd never done that before in American history, and we had child labor laws to keep them off the busy streets. For the first time, parents gave them allowances for good behavior. They no longer expected their kids to actually be working, you know, in the cities and rolling cigars and stuff and all the things that the previous generation of kids did. And this generation became associated with declining levels of risk-taking and rising levels of enthusiasm about being optimistic about the future and forging a closer community life. And in the 1920s, for example, this is the first Miss Americas, and we created tremendous stadiums in the 1920s, like the Rose Bowl, to host their huge football games. And then come the Great Crash in 1929, this is the generation that voted hugely for the party of community, the political party that represented community, namely the Democratic Party of the New Deal. An estimated 85% of these young adults in 1932 and 1936 voted for the New Deal. This was the first generation of African Americans to vote for the Democratic Party, no longer for the Republican Party. And this generation created, if there was a source of optimism about the 30s, and you certainly see it in the media with all these Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland movies, you know, very upbeat, and at the end of the 30s, these Disney movies that were always upbeat, this generation became famous for accentuating the positive. And where did that come from? Well, I think there are parallels to today, allowing for all the changes in history and technology and everything else, for today's millennial generation that's coming of age, which has represented a huge decline in personal risk-taking. We've seen a 60 to 70% decline in violent crime among youth over the last 20 years, probably the most dramatic reduction in youth violence in American history. We see record low rates of alcohol use and tobacco in grades 8, 10, and 12 in American schools today. In fact, the CDC has a whole ranking of youth risk surveillance indicators. The vast majority of these are all down. This is a generation today which wants to avoid risk, which wants to start saving early, and they are blanding the culture. They are taking the edge out of the culture, the edge and some of the darkness and cynicism that boomers and Xers put in the culture, and they're leading to what is some people in the media are calling the new nice. You know, people like Jimmy Fallon, you know, hosting the Tonight Show, no longer doing all the snarky jokes that his predecessors did. I think this is a sign of a new generation which has certain parallels and similarities. They're also obviously a generation voting for community. They're voting for the party of big government, just like the GI generation does. They're a hugely team-oriented generation, you know, given their technology, which is social networks, and even in the sharing economy you see this. And I would say one final thing to reflect on, which is a huge parallel, is that the 1930s saw this tremendous resurgence of multi-generational family living. Different generations got along very well in the 30s. They got along well together. We remember in film the Frank Capra homes. You remember those movies, You Can't Take It With You, or Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, those big rambling Victorian homes with all these different generations living in them. Well, partly that was a response to the Great Depression, but partly it reflected the fact that different generations got along very well. And I think you see the same thing again in America today. One of the least recognized trends today is the tremendous resurgence in multi-generational family living. The share of 25 to 34-year-olds living with their parents or with other older family members in 1980 was 11%. Today it's about 23%. I mean, that is a huge, you're talking about tens of millions of young people who are now living, with older family members.
Well, Neil, let me, one more question. This is a fascinating conversation. We're chatting today with Mr. Neil Howe. Neil, moving ahead, what type of political change do you see here in the maybe United States and worldwide, if that's a fair question?
Well, it's really hard to determine because I think we're reaching a, you know, I don't know, you want to call it a kind of a point of singularity, but a point at which it becomes very difficult to predict. I think fourth turnings is when political tensions and the search for a new kind of order and a new sense of direction build up to the point where almost anything can happen. What I do predict is that we're not going to go for more than another 10 or 15 years just simply plodding along in the same direction. And I think the search for community and order, which I think is actually one of the less recognized features of this new rising millennial generation, I think is going to become more conspicuous in the next several years. One surprising thing we've seen in Europe recently, and while we've seen it really around the world, is this retreat from globalism. We've seen it in attitudes, frankly, of all generations, both in America and in Europe, because globalism, you know, was supposed to bring us a new order, but everyone perceives it as being disorder in their own lives, right? And the kinds of shocks that it gives to the economy, to jobs, to culture, you know, immigration and so on, it tends to, we feel disordered in our lives. And I think the search for order, which is good, rise to various kinds of replacement, you know, some areas of the world is being called the new nationalism and the new localism. But looking back toward areas in your own locality, you know, in your own kind of very, very large extended family where you at least recognize what's going on, I think very recently we've seen this occur in Europe, where to the surprise of so many people, over the last year, we have seen young people vote for the anti-EU party. Who would have thought of that? I mean, they're voting for Le Pen in France. They voted for Nigel Farage in UKIP in Britain. We saw last weekend, in fact, young people between age 18 and 30 in Poland vote hugely in favor of the conservative, anti-EU, Eurosceptic Polish majority party, which is now for the first time doesn't even need to make a coalition. They're just going to go in and form their own government. This comes to a surprise to a lot of people. I was actually being interviewed by a Polish journalist recently, and he said that it's even a surprise to people in Poland that this is happening. So I'm just saying, you know, we talk about these similarities of the 30s. We talk about what's driving these things. We sometimes don't broaden our horizon to really see what's really going on here and where it's going to lead. We look for the each little event, but we don't look at some of these broader patterns. And I think these broader patterns are trying to tell us something.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Neil Howe. And Neil, you had mentioned that you have a free newswire, and maybe you could let the listeners know how to plug into that if they'd like.
We offer it at saculumresearch.com. Just go there and you can sign up for a newswire. We basically comment on generational and demographic trends in the media. A lot of it is product-oriented or just culture-oriented. And we do several of these a day. You can sign up either for the daily version or the weekly version. And that's, you know, free to free to those who want to sign up.
Well, terrific. Well, we've enjoyed having you on the program today and hope you'll come back.
Great. Thank you very much.
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. And in this segment, I will be continuing my conversation with Mr. Carl Denninger. Carl is a prolific blogger. You can read his work at market-ticker.org. And Carl, we closed this segment earlier talking about the fact that it was your belief that the Federal Reserve cannot engage in another round of money printing or quantitative easing because of the effect it would have on pension funds. There may be a disconnect in the minds of some of our listeners. Can you expand on that and explain?
Sure. Pension funds and insurance companies are essentially annuitizing products. That's what they do. And the way that they get their cash flow to pay the benefits that they've promised is by constructing a ladder in the bond market. So they buy, if you have a 20-year expected draw from a pension before you're, you know, actuarially you will die, the manager will build a approximately 20-year duration bond portfolio, and he does this by layering out bonds on a ladder. So every year, about a 20th of them roll off, and he replaces them. Well, when you engage in quantitative easing or other forms of interest rate manipulation, you drive down the return that those bonds are able to earn in terms of the coupon, that is the interest that they throw off. And so the first year that this happens, the pension fund has a 20th of its bonds get rolled over at a much lower rate. And that doesn't seem so bad because that's only about 5%. The next year, it's another 20th, though, and now it's 10%. And after 4 or 5 years, all of a sudden, the bond manager is looking at the return he's getting on his funds that he's got in the market doing this. And he says, hey, wait a minute, I'm short a quarter of the money I'm supposed to be getting. How am I going to pay these pensions? And so when it gets to the point that, you know, that this goes on for a length of time, these people start to do things like call up Bernanke, or in this case now Yellen, and say, excuse me, if this doesn't stop, we're going to go bankrupt because we have promised to pay these pensioners and these insurance beneficiaries this much money, and you know, we said we'd pay X, but we've only got X minus coming in. We can get away with this for a little while, but if you don't stop it, we're going to go under, and we're not going to be able to keep our promises. And so this is why quantitative easing and other forms of money printing, in a world where you have financial products that have a long duration and a guaranteed payout over that duration, is absolute rat poison. But it's a very slow-acting rat poison. And the worst news is that once you've accumulated this damage as a bond manager, you're stuck with it. So if the Fed was to stop all of its game playing in the interest rate market right now, and the short-term rates were to go back into the neighborhood of 3 or 4%, the 10-year Treasury in the mid-fives, it would be another, you know, 7-8 years before all of that damage rolled off through the bond funds. And there's nothing that can be done to short-circuit that, because if you sell those bonds and replace them, you crystallize that as a capital loss.
So, Carl, based on that, are you anticipating that we'll see more pension troubles moving ahead? Are we going to see more Detroit bankruptcies with the primary cause being pension underfunding?
Oh, absolutely. And you have a number of states right now that are in terrible trouble, Illinois being one of them. And this is going to get materially worse. This is the unsung song at this point. And the bigger problem that comes about is that this same damage has wound up in both the Social Security and Medicare funds as well, in the bonds that are held by those. And so this damage is going to end up rolling through federal beneficiary programs also. And those are the two big ones, of course, because with the boomers now retiring and accessing those programs, the payout load on those programs is going to rise for the next 15 to 20 years, and yet the rate of interest that those bonds earn has been capped for the last 7 or 8. So there's going to be a huge budgetary problem at the federal level 4 or 5 years down the road from now. And that same hit is going to start really pinching on the states and the local governments also.
So, Carl, when you take a look at some of the recent proposed changes to Social Security, namely the file and suspend strategy that now is not going to work for some beneficiaries, are we going to see other major changes to the Social Security program and Medicare program as a result of this?
Social Security is not the biggest problem. If you look at the numbers, Social Security as a program is technically insolvent, but it's relatively easy to fix. It will get in serious trouble in about another 15 years or so, but resolving that is not very hard. A relatively small change in policy with regards to the way the taxes are paid and how it's capped off would solve that. So you wouldn't have to remove the entire salary cap, for example. That's what some people are suggesting. It doesn't have to happen. Medicare, on the other hand, is it absolutely cannot continue as it stands today. But you can't fix the Medicare program as a program. You have to fix the medical monopolies in this country. If you don't, then Medicare ultimately, 10, 15 years from now, collapses. So does Medicaid, and so do the state and local pension plans, because the problem that they're having is in large part retiree medical care.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. It's amazing how fast a segment goes when we're talking with Carl. But, Carl, thank you for being with us today. You can read Carl's work at market-ticker.org. And, Carl, thanks for catching up with us from the road, and we hope you'll come back.
Anytime. Thanks.
Well, that is our program for this week. I'd like to take a moment and again acknowledge my special guest this week, Mr. Carl Denninger, whom you just heard from, as well as Mr. Neil Howe. And a quick reminder, if you'd like to go back and listen to any of the guest expert interviews from this week or any week for that matter, all you need to do is visit the website, everythingfinancialradio.com. That website, again, is everythingfinancialradio.com. Or you can visit the iTunes store and search under Everything Financial Radio. When you do that, you'll also have the ability to get a free subscription so that when the podcasts of the program are posted, they will automatically be made available to you. So again, everythingfinancialradio.com, or you can go to the iTunes store and search under Everything Financial Radio. On next week's program, best-selling author Harry Dent will be joining me. I caught up with Harry this past week, and I will be airing that conversation next week. I got some of Harry's predictions as to where the stock market is going and where the real estate market is going, and Harry's also making an offer to get his book, The Demographic Cliff, to our listeners for only a shipping and handling charge. So you want to stay tuned to that next week. And if you're not yet a subscriber to our newsletter, Portfolio Watch, Portfolio Watch is published each week. It is our commentary on what's going on in the markets and in the economy. If you're not yet a subscriber, it's very easy to get a free subscription. All you have to do is visit the website, yourretirementoutlook.com. That's Y-O-U-R, yourretirementoutlook.com. You just have to go on the site, give us your name and email address. You will be automatically a subscriber to the publication, and that's delivered each week, typically on Mondays after the market closes. So again, yourretirementoutlook.com to get a free subscription to that particular newsletter. Hope you have a great Thanksgiving week. Been a pleasure having you along today, and hope you have a great week.